Hello, and welcome to the Covenant of Mayors podcast, unlocking insights into how cities can adapt to climate change throughout Europe. I'm Anthony Coakley, and today I'll be speaking to João Denis, the head of the Accelerating Urban Transitions Office at Portugal's Cascais City Council. João leads on his city's climate and sustainability strategies. He has spent a decade ensuring a systemic, inclusive, and innovative approach to redefine the role of municipalities in the global movement for a sustainable future. And today, he's going to share some ideas with us about how cities can work with national and European governments to tackle climate change locally. João, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for this very, very kind invitation.
João, we know that local governments are the bedrock for climate adaptation. To what extent does the national level need to play a role?
Well, I would say that national level is to define policies and financing opportunities, as well as guidelines for cooperation. I think these are the principles for any joint work for cities. Of course, Portugal is a relatively small country, but we do have a lot of regional climate variations. And of course, because of that, the climate impact may vary. And I would say that with a national approach, we would be supported into which guidelines or to which strategies we should consider to be the most efficient. So that would be the main issue here.
Got you. So what is the national situation in Portugal? What are the policies in place and which are the main lines of action?
I would say that nationally, we already have some very ambitious climate plans from our carbon neutrality roadmap, but mostly for our national climate adaptation action plan. And of course, these are extremely important for us because they do give us a sense of what are the exact vulnerabilities that each region will face, what are the main guidelines, again, for each city to follow or to consider at least. So we are more or less on the same page when it comes to addressing climate adaptation. It's not a complete free world in the sense that we might get lost in our own ideas without any connection and without any cooperation or, let's say, co-creative process between ourselves. So I would say it's quite ambitious. And I think that with the very recent national law for climate, it was a new step forward towards local and national resilience.
Great. And just to follow up on that, you mentioned that you have these guidelines in place for each city. I suppose those are sort of blanket guidelines for all cities. So to what extent is the national level able to take into account the variability across cities in Portugal?
Well, I would say it does consider very well this variation between different cities, between different resources, adaptive capacities. What this new regulation provides us is guidelines that we should follow. So, and that's just it. So it states, for example, that by the end of 2024, we should have, I would say, a local action plan for the climate, both adaptation and mitigation as well. And obviously, that's a big step forward because cities will have to definitely give some effort, some financial, some technical staff hours for this challenge. And I see that as a great benefit because obviously, a lot of Portuguese cities are already taking the lead, but there are others yet to find the available resources to do this. So I would say that nationally, not only have we now have the expected regulation to go forward with this, but now we also have the financial opportunities to pursue this endeavor. And it is quite an endeavor. Of course, it's going to take many years to implement climate resilience strategies, but to define them, it will be in a very, very short term, thanks for these national law and national guidelines.
Right. And so when you're thinking about the national approach to adaptation, how do cities and regions fit into this wider strategy?
Well, Okay, that's a good question. I would say that they fit quite well, and they are a fundamental part of the resilience efforts. So the first thing that we should consider is that despite climate change, well, we can consider climate change a global phenomenon, it does have a very local impact. So in Portugal, it's quite visible that, for example, you have one city that has a response for adaptation or for a given emergency to extreme weather event, and the neighboring city might have a completely different one when it comes to resources, of course. So obviously, despite having the same vulnerabilities, the reaction is different. And the cities are in all of these sectors that are affected by climate change. They are the common denominator on all of them. So let's say, for example, health. So we have the national health services, and we have a national health policy. However, there are a lot of local health policies that are promoted with or by cities, because we are the ones that reach the citizens that are in elderly day centers or in schools or the vulnerable communities in a given geographical area. We are the ones who reach them the quickest and the most efficient. If you look at tourism, of course, tourism also has national guidelines, but the cities are the ones that are responsible for developing or at least maintaining what is the tourist product. So, for example, a given natural resource, a mountain range, a protected landscape, a coastal area, a dune system, and so on. So cities are also responsible for this. I could go on. I could go on with different sectors such as coastal management, biodiversity promotion, forest management, for including for the reply for fire hazard. There are lots, and we could do a podcast just for this. But that's what I mean, is exactly that we are in all of the implementation strategies. So despite having a national framework, cities are free to define themselves what are the main action that should be developed in which time frame and with which resources. And of course, this up and down, I wouldn't say bottom-up approach or top-down approach. I would say this meet us halfway approach is what is so successful about this thing, I would say.
It'd be interesting to hear from your experience, maybe to open it up a bit, about how these national guidelines have been transposed in your own city and the approach that you've taken to meeting them halfway.
Because we were pioneers, so our first local strategy for climate change was concluded in late 2009. And of course, it was quite innovative. And at the time, not a lot of municipalities were looking into it as efficiently as we were. But of course, we are a coastal municipality. We do have some forest fires. We do have some vulnerabilities. And it was a very good opportunity to finally understand what is going on and how will this impact or affect us. And obviously, this has a lot to do with the political leadership. Of course, they saw the relevance for the study, and we did it. And the conclusion was quite, I would say, in a very funny word, wow. Because we've learned so much from this strategy. We learned a lot of what we will face in the future. But of course, there are some uncertainty, which is normal for a pioneering project. And people looked into it, they read it, but some of the stakeholders didn't quite understood the relevance of it at the time. But we kept working. And because of this climate change engagement, the subject of climate change, one of the best approaches that we have is, we talk to our stakeholders, we talk to our internal departments, and we said to each other, you know what? This has valuable information, and it actually treasures the work that you are already doing. So let's consider this for our future work. And they did. And of course, we implemented a few projects very successfully. We developed a new climate change, which was at the time in 2017, the first climate change action plan, where we defined the measures and the specific actions within the 2030 timeframe. And again, it was the first time that any city in Portugal did this. And this was another milestone for us, because we finally reapproached the strategy in terms of let's do this because this is considered a priority. Whether before we were doing something like, okay, let's do this action because there's an opportunity to implement them. So obviously we never neglected the opportunities, but we went forward, which are the most relevant adaptation actions. And that's something that we did in 2017. And ever since, we've been implementing. And so far, I would say we have over 55 adaptation actions that are already concluded or in continuous implementation. And that is something that is a bit of an innovation for us ourselves. I was quite surprised that we had to divide between a one-shot implementation into continuous implementation. That means that climate adaptation is indeed transformative. It transformed the way that we work in the municipality between ourselves and within stakeholders and citizens. And that was a very enriching experience, as you can imagine.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And I'd love to hear more about it. But maybe to just get a bit further out in this idea of how cities have some freedom within the national guidelines to approach them in different ways. I know you're familiar with the work in a lot of different Portuguese cities. Could you perhaps give me an example of a way that your city or a different city have approached this differently with a different set of measures relative to their own contexts?
Well, that's a good question. And I would say that I don't have, luckily, something that is completely different from our approach. I would say that there is a lot of common ground due to our geographical approach. But I would say that the main difference is the priority that is given by decision makers to climate change here, whether in some cities, the climate change is not yet seen as a priority for action. But they don't deny that it's relevant to go forward with climate change adaptation. They're just not there yet. And I would say that this is due to different resources, different capabilities, and availability from their technical staff. But obviously, with the new national regulation, all of us will have to be on the same page in a very, very short time.
You've been working with the Covenant of Mayors to organize these workshops that brought cities together across Portugal to discuss the difficulties that they're having in accessing funding for sustainability. Did you find that cities have broadly similar challenges, or were there many outliers?
The technical staff from cities, I would say from any city in Portugal, we are extremely qualified and competent. And that gives me a lot of hope for climate change adaptation and the endeavors that we still have to promote. One of the things that we saw within these workshops is that they really like and they are very open to learning between each other. They love sharing their ideas and they love sharing their projects. And of course, it's this, let's call it an open source approach, has proven to be very, very beneficial and the center of the positive reviews that of any engagement that we've had so far with other cities. And of course, people always get out of there motivated and we exchange phones and we talk between ourselves very, very often. I get phone calls from people, hey, I have a challenge. How do you think we can surpass it? And we just share. And I do the same, of course. I face challenges all the time. And of course, I love sharing them with colleagues from other cities and learning together from them. And one of the things that is the most curious is cities that have small teams for climate change, the climate change sector, I would call it a department of climate change or climate action in this case. I would say that the smaller ones are usually the most creative and the ones that have genius ideas. And I love those ideas. And sometimes the smallest idea can bring a whole lot of change for a small community. And that's just wonderful.
Great. Can you give me an example of an innovative idea that you heard that's come from a small city?
Well, sure. Well, for example, they in a city up in the north of Portugal, they developed a green corridor, right? And what they've done is basically to establish a trail, which is something that we've done here ourselves very, very successfully. But what they've done is just a natural trail. So there's no pavement, there's no pebbles for people to walk. It's just natural dirt from a greenway corridor that is flooded from time to time. And what they've done actually is a communication campaign. And why is that relevant? What does it have to do? Because basically, they just cleaned the riverbed and the whole valley. And that allowed for people to walk through that area where they couldn't do that before. And what they've done is basically a campaign where they promoted ease of access, the leisure that you can get from there, the inspiration where you are in contact with nature, and why it has to be like this. Why can't we have pavement in here? And it was very interesting to see the amount of people that used that and used that in a very happy way, because they knew if their shoes were muddy, it's because it's the only possibility that they would have not to to permit the flooding of that area from time to time without doing any damage. So that's something that is new for us in Portugal. We don't usually do this approach. But it was something that is very interesting for me to learn that this is not a nature-based solution or anything. Obviously, it is. But the focus was on communication. And this is something that is intangible, but has a lot of impact as it keeps running in people's minds. And obviously, it was a pleasure to hear the technical staff to explain why they did this. And of course, they did this because they know the reality. They know the people. They know exactly what the people would think once they do this. And they did something which I called induced use. So people would go there. This is something new. But once they go there, they are followed. They are accompanied by people that can explain why this infrastructure is the way it is. And people were like, okay, it makes sense. So this is something completely new, because only climate change can bring these nature-based solutions that work towards this social goal, and also for this environmental and adaptation goal.
Yeah. And these things, especially having people that are accompanying people around these areas, is something that definitely requires funding. You mentioned that there were some similar challenges in funding. So could you maybe outline what those challenges are that Portuguese cities are facing in terms of funding their climate adaptation?
Okay, not an easy question to reply. So I would say, first, thank you very much for the European Commission and projects like Covenant of Mayors helping us, driving and guiding us towards funding that is well used for climate action and implementation. We also have that at national level with the Environmental Fund, for example, and some other programs that clearly qualify cities to do action to implement after the strategy, of course. And we also, let me say, for example, very quickly, the EEA grants program, which are also fundamental for the definition of the strategies in Portugal and funding these strategies so we could go forward all together. So the opportunities are there. So what are the challenges? Well, I would say that a lot of cities don't have the experience of applying grants for climate adaptation, which is a subject that usually takes a medium to long term of impact and implementation into political cycles that are only 4 years. So if we want to develop a project that is completely transformative and structural for a given geography, it would take a bit more than 8 years, I would say, so you could finally see the impact. You could implement something, for example, let's talk again about nature-based solutions. We could implement some nature-based solutions in a riverbed or in a forest area or whatever you consider. However, you would only see it matured after 4 years. And obviously, that's the challenge. So whenever I try to develop a project that has this time frame of implementation or at least a visibility, I try to divide it into quick wins. This is beneficial. First of all, because decision makers actually see something tangible and it's inspiring. And secondly, the citizens also see this. So I would say that the biggest challenge is to merge the values of climate adaptation and the values of the need for communication and awareness. And sometimes you're developing or designing a project that this doesn't quite fit well. It has to do a lot with marketing, which I'm really bad at, but I had to do it sometimes. And whenever I did it well, projects always succeeded. And I am very confident that despite these challenges, say the framework that is given or the guidelines are easy to follow. So far, any project that we've been implementing, any project that I know of from any other city, and we do know a lot because we work in network, everybody has been successful. So that's why I would say, instead of focusing on the challenges, I would focus on the thank you for allowing us to do this.
Well, definitely good to hear that note of optimism. I'd be interested to hear, for those listening, an example of this, if you can think of one off the top of your head, of a long-term project that, okay, you know you're not going to see the gains for maybe 10 years or beyond. How you package that to think about quick wins that can be appealing in the short term as well?
Well, I can give you two examples, actually, very quickly. We did develop one project with the Portuguese Environmental Fund that was to implement a local meteorological sensor network. So we implemented 5 meteorological centers that are completely certified, and they are very important for us because, surprisingly, Cascais has the oldest tide gauge in. That means that we've been measuring the sea level rise since 1885. How much is this worth, right? It's worth a lot. This is priceless for science, and it's right here in Cascais. So this is actually inspired to do this project, which is whenever we need information at local level to see, for example, heat waves or to see the local variations of temperature or urban heat island effects and so on, I couldn't get this information anywhere. So we designed this network, and to develop quick wins, not only do we design this network, but with today's online world, this is available freely for anyone on a web page. So what we promoted, we communicated this within research centers and basically told everybody, hey, use our information. Feel free to use our information. No worries whatsoever. And this actually allowed us to get a bit more studies for let's say, for local climate, for meteorological aspects, for resilience, and so on. So it's an incremental effect. And of course, we will only know the climate variations in 30 years, right? Because that's the long set that we need. And information needs to be processed by then. But it does give you a lot of outputs in the meanwhile, including, for example, for our friends, our very good friends and very active friends from the civil protection, that, for example, whenever they have a forest fire, they can access information easily. And then I would say, for example, we had the riverbed trail of Pinhas. That's a green corridor that, you know, from time to time it floods. We had one of the biggest floodings, destructive floodings ever in that at Valley, which is downtown of Cascais. And with a project called Base Adaptation, I think it was FP7 still project, we assessed the economic gains of just qualifying the riverbed to promote the infiltration and the flooding outside of the urban areas, obviously. And that actually inspired us to promote this project. And what we've done to add, a quick win, was a trail. And actually, this was sold as something that is completely transformative because now it is easily accessed. 25,000 people, first stage. Now, my colleagues from Cascais Ambiente finished the second stage. And I think now it reaches more or less 35,000 people. So imagine this, a valley, a greenway corridor that was completely renovated with nature-based solutions and to ensure that in case of severe flooding, we would get protection at the urban area. But not only that, but we also gained a new trail where people could walk, they could ride their bikes, and most importantly, they could commute daily downtown without using their cars. 35,000 people. So this is a very, very important win and a quick win as well.
What I notice is a common thread both in these two responses and earlier on, in terms of engaging people and also selling these climate actions, is to do with open access, giving people open access to data, information, or actual places, to landscapes. That seems to be a common thread here. Would that be a good analysis?
That's perfectly. actually. It's probably one of the most relevant ones because it does have a replication effect. So if it's something that the public could benefit entirely, if it's something that you could get acquainted with, for example, a given methodology as a staff member from a city, for example, I could replicate on my own municipality. That's something of a benefit as well. So that's why I would say it's perfectly good.
I'd like to give people listening to the podcast, whether or not they're working on the technical side of things in cities, maybe a little bit of insight here. So cities are developing things called Sustainable Energy and Climate Action Plans, with the unwieldy acronym of CCAPs, which I hear people throwing around all the time. And then they have to actually implement the things that they planned. So that's complex as well. Can you just break it down for our listeners? What are Sustainable Energy and Climate Action Plans? And what are the challenges that arise in developing them?
Good question. It's a challenging question. Well, to simplify things, for us to understand the impacts of climate change, we need to do a set of actions, okay? So the first one is to know exactly what is going to happen in future scenarios of climate change. So a CCAP does allow us, firstly, to understand what are all vulnerabilities and what are the impacts. Secondly, the CCAP also allows us to understand our emission standard. And that is important because climate change is indeed provoked by our excess of emissions in the atmosphere. And so each one of us needs to understand what exactly are we contributing for the problem. That would be the second one. So if you know exactly what is our contribution to the problem and what exactly is going to be the problem here, we can now develop an action plan. And that's the third part, which is we develop an action plan for adaptation. So a set of actions that will increase our resilience to the changing scenarios, and a set of actions that regards energy efficiency to reduce our carbon emission footprint. So that's obviously something very, very important. And finally, when we define these actions, we have to implement them, right? And we have to monitor their impact. For example, energy actions. Are they indeed reducing our emissions? Are we having a good contribution to mitigate the problem? Or when it comes to adaptation, are we indeed implementing these actions? Are they contributing to vulnerability and risk reduction or not? So it's important to measure these things as well, because remember, they have a medium to long-term impact. And so a CCAP does allow us to have a broad yet specific approach on climate action. And that is why they are so important. And within the Covenant of Mayors, let's say we have a CCAP, let's say a report, a book that you can put on a shelf next to hundreds and thousands of other CCAPs from other cities, where you can retrieve and get the biggest amount of information possible.
You've already shared that your city has been kind of ahead of the curve, but when you heard from other cities, maybe to a listener, they would think, okay, writing a plan, even if implementing it is difficult, actually writing it shouldn't be so hard. But cities do struggle with this part of the process. So could you tell me, what are the main hurdles they're coming up against in actually devising an appropriate plan for their areas?
So we have to understand that cities have a very broad range of obligations and tasks to comply with, right? So it ranges from fixing the hole on the road, the pothole, and to developing economic strategies for local development within a given political view, and obviously to also engage into environmental policies that will have impacts for decades to come. And that's very challenging for an organization. So many tasks, so many responsibilities, so many diligences to tackle in short, medium to long term. And climate change is one of the most challenging ones, because it is something that cities are now facing very recently, and it's the knowledge that it brings. It's very demanding. So to establish something that is a climate scenario, you usually need, or certainly need, a lot of very experienced experts, science experts, that will tell us what the climate scenarios point to. And that's obviously a hurdle for us as well, because we don't have these type of competencies. And quite frankly, with the networking that we are achieving, I think that in the future we will work very well. But it's still challenging now for any city to access easily this type of information, which is, you know, a stone ground for our work. And then when it comes to climate change adaptation and mitigation, obviously these have a broad range of sectors that need to be implemented. Again, like I said, we have tourism, we have coastal zones, we have biodiversity, we have civil protection, we have spatial planning and zoning all together. And the common management of this is probably the biggest challenge, because everyone is doing their work in their own little boxes, in their own little worlds, and that's very common in cities. However, to tackle climate change, you need to completely destroy this vertical approach and make it a horizontal approach. And obviously, that's another organizational challenge. But like I've mentioned before, the actions that we are seeing now implemented, they were very transformative, because, you know, like you've said it yourself, this is open source. And obviously, within our own city, we work in an open source approach. So we share everything between ourselves and we add value.
So on the one hand, there's a long-term ambition of wanting to become more transversal, more holistic in terms of an approach. And on the other hand, there's a more short-term realizable ambition of creating more opportunities to share knowledge and to exchange ideas with cities that are more advanced.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say that the cities that are more advanced are just the ones that started earlier, but other cities could easily catch up.
Right.
That's not even in question.
When it comes to implementation, we already mentioned one obvious hurdle, and that's money, being able to find finance for these plans once they come into place. Are there any other serious barriers that need to be taken into account?
Coming from the previous question where I stated that the medium to long-term impacts and duration of an implementation of adaptation action, I would say that is the biggest, probably the biggest challenge, which is the multidisciplinary nature of climate adaptation. So it's something that usually takes a lot of time to see results, but it's something that is constructed with a lot of teams, a lot of input, not only from the cities themselves, but with stakeholders from the cities. That would be the biggest challenge. And it's something that it's very, very challenging to manage. So many interests, so many approaches, so many different methodologies. So building a common ground in due time, implementing it, and then follow up with the results. Wow, it's a challenge. Yeah.
Sure, I can bet. You've already shared with us that your city's been super successful and an early starter in this domain. Can you share a particular example of a challenge that your city has overcome and how you managed it? Or maybe it's something that's still a thorn in your side.
I would say, given that we need to work together internally and with stakeholders, I would say that I still need to share more knowledge on how to apply to these grants that European Union and even national government getting to support our endeavors on climate adaptation. And it's definitely a challenge, because cities are overwhelmed with challenges, right? And for me to add a solution and financial capabilities to that solution, I need to bring it to the top of the hierarchy for implementation on their own working agenda. And obviously, if you're doing your work and you have a working agenda and you have responsibilities to add something new that needs to be done by tomorrow, it's extremely challenging, obviously. And everybody recognizes this is a great opportunity. We might be missing out something else. So obviously, when we talk about climate action in cities, I think we need to strengthen our teams and also strengthen our collaboration. That's a big challenge.
Right. And that's true among cities, but also, I guess, on a multi-level dimension.
Yes, absolutely. And luckily, cities have been working really well between themselves, sharing knowledge and working jointly to develop a project that is with different pilot case studies within the same project. That's something of great interest. But at the same time, it is a challenge to do this within implementation at the city.
You've spoken a lot about stakeholders, both on the local and the national level. Can you speak to how cities work with other stakeholders to create a more effective governance environment to help these adaptive processes take place?
So we need to bring stakeholders in a way, in a positive way. Usually when I have conversations or debates or even during conferences, there's quite a few professionals that keep mentioning the barriers and the hurdles that they need to surpass, which is fairly normal. And it's fair to mention because we face this every day. And but I think that we need to focus more a bit on the solutions. And when you focus on the solutions, stakeholders are more aware. They listen more. And so we listen to them and say, we have these challenges. Great. We might have these solutions. So let's discuss the way out of this hole that you're in. Well, we're in together. And obviously, if you have this approach, it is quite more productive. Something that we always do in any sector of climate change. And so far, it's been worked well. But when it comes to implementation for these sectors, they also need to access funding. They also need to access support. And sometimes when we're doing this ourselves, we cannot reach of our line of responsibility. So this happens quite often within, not so much with adaptation, but within mitigation as well. So for adaptation, for example, sometimes my colleagues from Cascais Ambiente, the municipal company of the town hall, they have to work to promote the biodiversity of the national park. So it's a heritage, natural heritage park. So it's classified. And it's not necessarily or traditionally our obligation to do that. But we, our decision makers, saw we clearly need to do more. So my colleagues are challenged to do this, but obviously they can't go as much as they would love to because it's private land, privately owned. It has to go under authorization process from national authorities and so on. It's very challenging. This, for example, from our colleagues as well from the civil protection, where they take care of the coastal zones and they have to analyze the landslides or the rockfalls in coastal areas. And of course, they need to consult the national agency, the environmental agency, and they need to consult local national authorities, the coastal authorities in this case, to make sure that what can they do? Because it needs to be done. And trust me, they want to do a lot. But sometimes these are the hurdles that we need, that we face. The common ground, however, is that everybody sees that this is beneficial for everybody. So if you go well with a good governance model and a good spirit, inclusive spirit, everybody participates. And in mitigation, which is very relevant because of nowadays with the energy crisis that we're facing, I think that we finally hit, let's say, a mental milestone, which is that everybody's aware that we need to decentralize energy production and invest more in photovoltaic production, every house or in every building or whenever we can. And obviously, we wanted to do this and we wanted more, but the national regulation prevented us to ask more from citizens. And it's normal. And maybe it wasn't fair of us to ask, for example, a person that is building a new house, well, you should invest right now on solar panels. Luckily, now it's a much better deal. And there are many more governance and economic and market-based models that are really convincing and are really attractive for citizens to do this. So there's always a way out, I would say. There's always a solution. And it's something that this spirit has been driving me. So I always see challenge and solution. I never see challenge alone. So, for example, we are now, thanks to a national regulation that was approved at the end of 2019, that we could finally energy communities, right? So energy communities are a simple concept, but extremely complicated to implement due to technical slash bureaucratic processes that are needed. I couldn't just implement or place solar panels in my house and then just wait for someone to buy my energy. There's a lot of normal bureaucratic processes. I need to register myself as a prosumer. I need to understand if the grid could support the input of energy that I'm giving. We need to make sure that there's someone that is buying the energy, that it's not lost. There needs to be someone that manages this this network, this community, which is a certified entity with certified software and accounting and so on. So that's a challenge. However, we've been seeing that people are really, really keen to do this. So let's say we're building this by different parts. People are buying more solar panels for self-consumption. Companies are promoting self-consumption in infrastructure. Let's say, for example, a day center for the elderly, which is something that we've recently had, where they deliberately over-dimension it, the solar production, so they could easily sell that whenever there's a low peak of consumption. And the market is seeing this because both consumers and producers, and therefore prosumers, are starting to be quite keen on this. And right now, we're right about to achieve a milestone, which is there's a general market appreciation of this model. And I'm pretty sure that if we were to have this conversation in just a couple of years, we would have tens, if not hundreds, of people and infrastructure already engaged in energy community. And let me just say that whenever we organize a workshop to study the interest of citizens on this, they really come with a lot of enthusiasm. And we usually design the worst case scenarios for return of investment. And they say, I don't care. It still sounds like a pretty reasonable investment for me. So this is wonderful, this energy, despite the hurdles that I mentioned.
Great. You dropped in the term prosumer there. Could you explain that for us before we move forward?
Okay, so a consumer, I live in a house and I consume energy that comes from the grid, right? However, some of us actually have solar panels, photovoltaic solar panels, and they're becoming a bit more interesting for people that have electric cars, right? So I'm also producing energy, but in a self-consumption way. However, if I inject part of my energy in the grid and someone else gets this energy, then I am a producer and a consumer at the same time. I am a prosumer. It's a wonderful figure, and it's something that it's really, really empowering in terms of energy efficiency. We are actually now part of the equation for the energy transition that we so desperately need.
You've been working together, you already mentioned, with other cities on the national level. But you talked about the benefit of the Covenant of Mayors, which is a Europe-wide and indeed on one level global initiative. Could you speak about your experience working with cities, not just in Portugal, but around Europe? Has this been something that inspired you, or indeed an opportunity for you to inspire others?
Well, let me reply this way. I am very privileged to be here today in this podcast representing a lot of people that are actively working. But to put a personal perspective, I would say I really, really love the Covenant of Mayors and the European approach on climate cooperation and city cooperation. And I think that everybody feels the same way. So the Covenant of Mayors is an extremely inclusive process. And a city that is on, you know, on high tech, top of the game on climate action, and a city that is just barely starting, they are on the same chessboard and they are exchanging experiences. Isn't this wonderful? I think that's the main message and the main approach or benefit from the Covenant of Mayors. The Covenant of Mayors give us tools, they give us methods, they give us networking, and they give us opportunities for funding, and they empower us. The Covenant of Mayors is empowering cities, is empowering citizens. It's something that it's probably one of the best environmental, development, economic, social, sustainable programs that the European Union and now globally has ever produced. And every day, I love them even more.
We don't have much time left, so I'd love it if we could dive into the personal level. Would you be comfortable sharing a story with me about your work in this area, a memory that sticks out that helps to remind you in a kind of a human way how all this climate stuff relates in the end back to the people that you serve?
So I've been doing this work for on this sector for 15 years now. And it's been some very intensive 15 years. That's the price you get to be a front-running city, right? There was probably one lady that and one man within the same project that I really treasure their evaluation of our work. Not only because of the value they give it itself, but the way they explain the value for them. So when we were doing this greenway restoration and a trail that goes from downtown Qashqai to the mountain range, within that valley, that very steep valley, there is a lady that lives in a house, which is a very lonely house. But, it's for a little corner. And when I was trying to surpass the challenges that we were facing, I was on the field, of course, you can't do this on the office. And the water was running through everywhere near the river creek. And this lady comes up with wellies, you know, the boots to be on the water. And she was curious and asked me, "What are you doing here?" I was like, "Oh, I work at the municipality and I'm trying to assess who are the owners and what are the best solutions for us to restore a very ancient trail that is here while at the same time promoting, you know, the cooling of Qashqai to this greenway. Also to promote flooding in basin areas, which is something complex." And she said, "Oh, that's so very important. Unfortunately, I feel like this area was abandoned many, many years ago because the trail is gone. I can't even walk out of my house without boots." And then she proceeded to explain me in a very emotional moment how her husband, who was at the time fighting an illness and eventually passed away, couldn't get out of the house in an ambulance because there was no access to her house. And she says that this has been for years now. And I told her very confident of, you know, like a confidence. I told her, "You know what? I'm probably one of the most stubborn people in this guy. So I'll reach a solution for us. And we have excellent experts that work on this sector. And they will definitely find the best solution." And so we did. And on the day that we finally concluded and did this presentation, she came out of the house and she hugged the mayor. And she was crying. She was crying very, very much. And she said, she told him, "Thank you so much." And she looked at me and she said, you really changed my life." And I like to think that she was one of the now 35 people we changed their lives with just this project. This is the most emotional example that I can give you of how climate adaptation can change a person's life and a whole community's life as well.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that with me. I think it's so important to remember that climate change is not something abstract, but that it really has this personal dimension. So thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the ultimate transitioning process for a sustainable society.
One final question, and it's sort of, is there light at the end of the tunnel? Every time we look at the news these days, we see that the condition around climate change is getting more and more dire. We see the results of these big conferences, and we see continued resistance from many actors against making the changes that we need to make to get climate change under control. As someone who's really on the front line in cities trying to make this change, can you tell me if you have an optimistic view on how this is all going to turn out, if it's going to be possible to hit the targets that we've set out for ourselves and that we need to make if we're going to get this situation back to where we need it to be?
Adaptation, climate adaptation is very organic, and we have no other option but to adapt. The question is, are we adapting to grasp the biggest amount of opportunities that we can get? We will always adapt, and we will always surpass our challenges. And I would say that there is absolutely no way that we can turn back on our energy transition effort, because both decision makers, citizens, and stakeholders finally seeing that going through this way is actually probably the most competitive way. They are grabbing and grasping a lot of benefits, whether it's to develop new technology, whether it's to have a better sense of what's important in your lifestyle and in your community. And it's never a step back, which is something that I've been hearing a lot. Oh, it's going back to the times of our grandparents. No. Definitely moving forward. It's probably readapting to what were some of the lifestyle items that we had in the past and bringing them to our more sustainable consumption levels and new technology and new mobility patterns and new working methods and spatial planning. I think that we will succeed, and some will succeed more than others, but we will all together succeed.
Great. Heartening final words, João Denis. Thank you so much for joining me on the Covenant of Mayors podcast and sharing your ideas today.
Thank you. Thank you again for this very kind invitation. And thank you to all there are in both Portugal and in Europe or in the world that are inspiring me with their solutions and their knowledge. Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you for joining me for this first Covenant of Mayors podcast. I hope you enjoyed what you heard, and I hope that it's useful for you and potentially for your work. You can find a full transcript of the podcast at covenantofmayors.eu. And if you have any questions or comments, please don't hesitate to get in touch. Speak to you next time.